Kia ora and welcome to this episode of Better Off Red. My name's Pip Adam and this is episode 42, but it's also our first episode for 2017. So yes, I'm very grateful to Daniel McLaughlin, a Wellington writer who sat down to speak with me about James Gleick's book, Time Travel, A History, which is just, I can't quite explain how much I enjoyed this book. It is just so magnificent. And Daniel recommended it for one for us to talk to, which I'm incredibly grateful about. And yeah, it's just magnificent. Yes, I would highly recommend it. Anyway, Daniel is a Wellington writer, as I think I said before. He has written two novels. Unspeakable Secrets of Arrow Valley was published in 2013 by Victoria University Press, and Mysterious Mysteries of Arrow Valley was published last year. The books have been described as dark and hilarious. They have also been described as dark and forbidding and a comic farce. They're both very funny books, but they're also, I guess, like all the best comedy, they're extremely well structured and thought out and crafted, and they're both very funny and I highly recommend them. Daniel also blogs. He is at dimpost.wordpress.com, and he has written a couple of essays for the spin-off, and I'll put links to those there as well. Before I sort of launch into the podcast that we recorded, I just wanted to read a couple of paragraphs from James Gleick's book, just to sort of give you an idea of where we're at. Yeah, just so that you can sort of hear his voice and then see what we talk about, because we are very excited about this book. Probably me more so, because I get embarrassingly enthusiastic. Anyway, so this is from the first chapter of the book. A man stands at the end of a drafty corridor, aka the 19th century, and in the flickering light of an oil lamp examines a machine made of nickel and ivory, with brass rails and quartz rods, a squat, ugly contraption, somehow out of focus, not easy for the poor reader to visualise, despite the listing of parts and materials. Our hero fiddles with some screws, adds a drop of oil, and plants himself on the saddle. He grasps the lever with both hands. He is going on a journey, and by the way, so are we. When he throws that lever, time breaks from its moorings. The man is nondescript, almost devoid of features, grey eyes and a pale face and not much else. He lacks even a name. He is just the time traveller, for so it will be convenient to speak of him. Time and travel. No one had thought to join those words before now. And that machine, with its saddle and bars, it's a fantasticated bicycle. The whole thing is the invention of a young enthusiast named Wells, who goes by his initials, HG, because he thinks that sounds more serious than Herbert. And so begins James Gleick's magnificent book, Time Travel, and I hope you enjoy this podcast. Okay, so here I am. How are you, Daniel?
I'm good.
That's good, yeah. We were just saying how the weather is sunny but windy, I think. Does that sum it up?
Yep.
Yeah, I think it does. So we're here today and we're going to talk about a book by James Gleick, which is called Time Travel. And I don't know, like, I came across it because you recommended it, but I'm wondering how you came across it.
I don't remember exactly. I would have read about it on the internet somewhere. I would have read a review or something. And the author, James Gleick, is just one of my favourite writers. And we were talking the other day about how normally when someone asks you who your favourite writers are, we both kind of think of novelists. But he's not a novelist. He's traditionally a science writer. All this is kind of part science and part sort of culture and literary theory. And so, yeah, he's someone, just about one of the only contemporary writers whose work I'll just, you know, read because, you know, because I try to read everything he writes. Mm. And so, yeah, I picked it up and, I thought it was amazing. It's, you know, as good as anything else he's written.
So can you just to sort of backtrack,
He's also written the book on information. Sounded really interesting. What's that called?
It's called The Information.
Yeah.
And a History of Flood, I think, is the subtitle.
Yeah. And is that? Can you talk a little bit about what that's about?
It's basically kind of a history of humanity, seen through information theory. So it kind of starts out with, pre-literate oral cultures and villages sending smoke signals to each other and the compression of info, African drum signals and that kind of thing, and the sort of compression of information that happens. And so then it goes through literacy and dictionaries and alphabets, and then mathematical theory, entropy, modern information theory, black holes, Wikipedia. So it's just, information is something that has kind of deep and non-intuitive links to contemporary physics, to cosmology, to chemistry and philosophy. So it's a really interesting perspective on human history, really, and intellectual history.
So time travel, how, like, the name kind of says it all, but how would you describe that book?
So it is, I was thinking about this because I reread it yesterday to kind of think about it again, and it's actually a book that does a bunch of different things. It is about it starts out talking about the H.G. Wells novel The Time Machine, and I read that book earlier this year before I knew that this book was coming along. And one of the things, it's a really good book and people listening to it should read it if they haven't, one of the things that really struck me about that book when I read it is that Wells invented a genre. People didn't write about time travel before that, and he was, kind of the first to do so. And as a writer, I immediately thought, how do I do that? How do you invent a genre? Because, that's really a kind of, it's an extraordinary creative thing to do, much more so than just sort of writing a book yourself. Inventing a genre, which lots of other people then imitate, and which kind of gets picked up in the culture and goes into other mediums, is really, it's a really high bar. It's, to me, that would be better than, there's no award that I could win that would kind of, compare with that. And so anyway, but this book kind of answers that question. How did he invent this new genre? And Gluck says that the end of the 19th century, when Wells was writing, was really a time when the way people thought about time itself had really transformed. Prior to that, people's lives weren't materially that different from their grandparents and their parents, and they didn't think that the future would be that different. Mm-hmm. Or if they did think about the future, they tended to think of it in apocalyptic terms because they were religious and the world would end and God would come. And writers, Shakespeare, for example, he talks about when he was writing about ancient Rome or ancient Egypt, they had mechanical clocks and billiard tables, and Renaissance painters painted Jesus and his disciples just looking like Florentine merchants. People didn't have this radically different concept, this conception that the past was radically different. And then in the 19th century, you had archaeology became a thing, and people were digging up tombs in Egypt, and they could go to the British Museum and see these relics that showed that people actually did live very different lives. And you also had Darwin and Lyell, biologists and the geologists, talking about how the Earth was just much, much, much older than reasonable people thought that the Earth was 6,000 years old. And these guys said, no, it's many millions of years old. And also you had very rapid technological change. You had urbanization, industrialization. Instead of working on farms, people were working in factories. And so for the first time, you had this concept that the past and the future were going to be very different. You had this idea of futurity. I'm not even sure if I'm saying that properly. And so, Wells was really kind of tapping into that concept that time itself had changed.
Mm. And I loved even that stuff about the idea of the bicycle and how there was the machine where you could sit at home and bicycle but not go anywhere.
Yes,
so Wells was kind of like, oh, we're traveling in time but we're not traveling in, just that whole wonderful mashup of all that sort of stuff.
Well, that's one of the things that Gluck talks about in this book, which is really interesting, is that like a lot of writers, Wells has this sort of pseudoscientific justification for how his book works, and he has his Hero saying, you know, time is actually a dimension, like, you know, it's like three-dimensional space. And he was writing that just quite a long time before Einstein and Minkowski. So, and it's a funny thing. There's a Wagner opera, Parsifal, I think it is, where it also, which is written at about the same time, it also has characters saying, now space is going to turn into time and that kind of thing. So it really was just something that was in the kind of, I don't know, in the culture, this idea of space-time, before it was even articulated by physicists and mathematicians, that artists and writers were thinking about this stuff.
Or H.G. Wells was in a causal loop.
Well, yeah, maybe. Yeah.
This is something that I so loved about the book, was this, I don't even know how to describe it, but I think I had a go talking to you the other day. Like, it's not like these very complex ideas, because there are some exceptionally, well, I'm not very smart, there are some exceptionally complex ideas in the book, in Gleick's book. And it's not like he dumbs down those ideas or tries to give you a metaphor for those ideas or something like that. He just seems to form, like the way you were talking about the information book, he sort of forms this argument, I guess would be the old-fashioned way of sort of thinking about it. But each piece of information kind of builds on, and you know, like the time machine comes back and back and back in some of the chapters. And, you know, like once we've got that fictional cultural idea secure, then he builds on that. I don't know, is that a fair summation? Like, is that what do you like about his writing? That I was think, a long-winded way of saying that.
I mean, I think you can make an argument. I think that Gleick is the best science writer I've ever read.
Yeah,
and there's a point in The Information where he's talking about Kurt Gödel, who's a, like, you know, mathematician, logical theorist, and Gödel formed the I'm slightly confused, the incompleteness theorem, which was kind of this, which I'm not even going to try to explain because I'll just make a fool of myself, but I've read so many kind of books about, you know, philosophy of mathematics and that kind of thing, and I just never understood it, and it is a really, really hard thing to understand, and he, Gleick, in this book explained it to me, and I got it, and I don't really have it anymore, but, you know, he did make me understand that that kind of complicated, abstract, quite opaque idea. So, I think he is a really, really great writer. He's writing in a genre where that kind of greatness isn't really acknowledged so much as, other mediums, I think. The contemporary, like the literary equivalent of Gleick is someone like Hilary Mantel, I think, someone who is just really world famous and celebrated.
Is time travel a genre that you read? Yes. And what would be your favourite, you know, whether it's TV or film, or what would be your favourite kind of time travel movies?
What would I like?
Anything.
Well, you know, that original book, The Time Traveller, is really very good. There's another story in Time Travel which Gleick talks about, which is a Robert Heinlein story called By His Bootstraps. It's amazing.
Holy crap.
It's such a sort of perfect little kind of... Yeah,
and it's mind-blowing, and it delivers that same, like, I really like Primer, which is a film from years ago, and it was made with no budget. What I couldn't believe is that often when I watch films, I think you could never do this with a book or anything like that, but that By His Bootstraps, that in the stomach, when you realise he's got a bruise on his head, he's about to climb through, oh my God, you know, and like that absolute perfection of... who knows what, you know, like the reader's ahead of the character, and then the character's ahead of the reader, and just an incredible story.
Heinlein's an odd writer. When I was a teenager, I read almost everything he wrote, which is not something I would recommend that anyone does. But he has these amazing high points in his career, that's one of them, and they tend to be, like, he wrote this book called Stranger in a Strange Land, which is kind of like this sort of, I don't know, icon of hippie, kind of the hippie era, and, you know, it was really fashionable in the 60s and 70s, and he also wrote a book called The Moon is a Harsh Mistress, which is sort of like a libertarian classic, which is the exact opposite of everything that he seems to be kind of arguing for in this other book. So he's an odd writer in that respect.
A writer for money, eh?
Like, very much like, L. Ron Hubbard and all those guys,
yeah,
and Lovecraft, that were doing amazing stories, and those sort of pulps. Yeah, they were Phil Dick. They were really doing it for the money, and so yeah, and their output was phenomenal.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm just trying to think. There are a few other interesting books that he talks about in there. An Asimov book called The Ends of Eternity, which is also pretty good. It's a funny because it's a book of literary criticism mostly, but most of the books that he's talking about, the kind of canonical texts, are books that people who are normally very literary would not have read or even heard of in most respects. And it's a funny thing. And again, I've often thought that science fiction was a much more significant kind of literary form than, you know, that it hasn't gotten the attention that it deserved, that some of the books really were incredibly influential.
Yeah, because I was just, I mean, it prompted me again to think of Lathe of Heaven, which is like one of my favourite books.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think you're right. Like, if someone said to me, oh, favourite books, it's funny because
you
I see.
To think of something important.
Yes.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, I must admit that my science fiction books feel like. No, they don't. That's a lie. I was going to say they feel more like pleasure than, you know, critical reading. But, I mean, even last year when I was reading The Martian, I was an incredible, you know, I was watching how that was structured and what was going on. And so I think you're dead right about science fiction. What if you had to point to one of the chapters that were your favourite in the Gleek book, could you do that, do you think?
I don't know.
Because it doesn't sit, you know, like at first I thought maybe these were separate essays put together, but it's not really like that, eh?
There is one about paradoxes, which I think is really good. And at the end, the final description is describes another of my favourite time travel stories, which is La Jetée, the Chris Marker, which I suspect you can probably just watch on YouTube.
I did.
Yeah.
I was astounded.
Yeah, and that really is an amazing, It's sophisticated as well. You don't have to sort of feel embarrassed about admitting to people that you like La Jetée, which you do with maybe sort of Terminator 2 or Robert Heinlein. But
Terminator.
Yeah.
Because that was what was really interesting. Oh, sorry, I'm totally going off on a culture tangent. But I totally had forgotten about 12 Monkeys and forgotten about the La Jetée 12 Monkeys sort of combination. And it was incredible. It was really incredible. I was excited, obviously, because I'm a little bit of a fan, but that's the first time I think I've seen David Foster Wallace's critical thesis anywhere, you know, like and I it was really interesting for me because I've always, now you can laugh at me, I've always been interested in this idea that logic and philosophy is a lot about maths and equations, and I've never really understood that combination until I read this book, because it does it doesn't shy away from saying this is the equation, that sort of thing. So I found it really interesting in that.
I didn't really understand the logic part of that, I have to admit.
No.
I went back and reread it, but I still didn't really get it.
What do you mean?
Yeah.
It was, I liked that there were, I really liked the fact that this book might be one that I could definitely come back to and read over and over again. It would be very cool. One of the things that, again, I found really appealing and have always found quite appealing is the idea of multiple world interpretation.
Yes.
This is a rambling question that I've been thinking about. And I was just thinking, when I was rereading your books, Mysterious Mysteries is of Ara Valley is kind of foremost in my mind. This idea, do you imagine the Ara Valley that you're creating in those works is one that's happening now, like as I walk to the shop, there's a giant somewhere, or is this, in my house sometimes, is it an alternate world of Ara Valley, or are those just not concepts, like where there are different rules? Like, how are those things that you plan for, or are you, can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, the way I always kind of thought about it was, because I lived in Ara Valley, you know, when I was in my early 20s, and I kind of, you know, was unemployed some of the time and kind of had crappy jobs, and you know, my friends and I were sort of wanted to be writers, and we were reading and writing lots of weird stuff. And I ended up going overseas for a couple of years, and I ended up working in the finance industry. And I kind of came back and kind of found that my friends were living to me, like kind of going back and seeing that life again with fresh eyes. It sort of struck me how they wanted to be writers, and so did I at the time, but we were living quite comic lives filled with, you know, great stories, but we didn't really see it. It just seemed normal to us. And so I always kind of thought that the sort of, because the character in the book is Danil, and I always kind of thought that it was the sort of the Danil not taken, that if I'd kind of stayed in Arrow Valley, then that kind of, yeah, that's what, you know, that character is kind of what I would have been like. I didn't really think that, I didn't really think about sort of, I don't know, many worlds or alternate realities, at least not in that respect when I was writing the book. There is, I mean, the book does talk about, the Mysterious Mysteries talks about sort of many worlds in a different way, and it kind of, I was interested in, it talks about alternate universes, but the alternate universes in that book aren't really, are incredibly alien places where, you know, the sort of, the fundamental rules of reality are different, and there are, you know, it's kind of, I don't know, hard to articulate just as I'm standing there. I had to write a whole book to try and get the idea across, and I don't know if I did or not.
Yes, yeah. I think you did. Yeah. And, like, that's what I think is really interesting about the book as well, is that it completely, you know, some people will write a book and pretend that it's somewhere else.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, they might say, this
yeah.
is the Mysterious Mysteries of
yeah.
Oura Valley or
yeah,
something
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And yet, a lot of the fun in it, because it is fun, God forbid,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
And often a lot of the poignance of it as well comes from the fact that there is this real place.
Yeah.
You know, like, there's a joke early on about the children in the daycare centre.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, growing the vegetables and
yeah.
all that sort of stuff. And the thing is that if you, you know, like, the real Arrow Valley is kind of echoing in that.
Yeah.
I think you've probably answered this question.
One weird thing that happened when I was writing the second book is that I decided the Arrow Valley needed an archive.
Yes.
And so I just sort of, like, invented this building, which is like a squat concrete bunker that's kind of next to the town hall, and I kind of thought, you know, okay, well, you know, it's my book, so I'm allowed to just invent buildings. But there actually is a building
yeah.
that's there, which is kind of like that. And because I don't live in Arrow Valley now, it was like about a year between me sort of inventing this building and then going back there and seeing that it is actually there, which was a little bit strange. And I kind of wondered, was that there before I wrote about it? But, yeah, it's a funny thing because I didn't... When I was writing the first book and I kind of decided that it was going to be set in Arrow Valley and that I was just, wasn't going to change the name and, I didn't really have any kind of, I just sort of, it was an intuitive thing. I didn't really have like a theoretical reason for doing that. And something that I found after I did that is that there are kind of a number of writers in the US who are writing what's, they call it the new weird, I think, Jeff Vandermeer, who wrote the Southern Reach trilogy, which is amazing, who are kind of doing that kind of writing, this sort of like, that it's just consciously set in the real world and it's about them, but it's, you know, fictional and often it's genre, and it's sort of, he talks about how it kind of, Ballard did that a lot as well. And now that I think about it, and yeah, it sort of is related to this theory that, I don't know, contemporary life is sort of so suffused with kind of artifice and make-believe anyway, that to kind of, yeah, write sort of realistic fiction, you kind of have to embrace that and be writing about the real world.
I totally agree. Like, I just think, I totally agree. Now I'm going to go all biographical.
Okay.
So you grew up in Wellington?
Yeah, I grew up in Plymouthen.
Oh,
yeah,
nice.
Yeah,
oh,
yeah.
I like it there. And then you...
Yeah, me too. I really wish I could afford to live there as a grown up.
Oh, to afford to live somewhere nice.
Yeah.
And then, so you came to university here?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, and what were you doing? You were not doing maths at that stage,
No, I never... I studied... So, like, I have an unfinished arts degree, so I studied classics and religious theory, and and then, but I didn't do any work, and I didn't really do any reading, and
So you were, and that at that point was being a, was that the point where you and your friends were writing? What do you think made you, most boring question you can ask a writer. What do you think made you start writing?
No, I don't know. I honestly don't know. I guess I just kind of like, it was, I liked reading, and then I kind of, you sort of identify writers that you liked, and I was young, and I liked, Hemingway and Fitzgerald, and I kind of thought it would be nice to have a life like that, and, like, obviously the right of a contemporary writer is just as far from their lives as you can pretty much get. But yeah, so I kind of think that had something to do with it, just sort of idolizing writers, and
Yeah. And then when did the maths come in?
No, I never really studied maths. So my degree is in biology, and I also did some postgraduate studies in computer science, and so which is quite mathematical. You study discrete and combinatorial mathematics, but I'm actually quite a terrible mathematician. I'm just like I'm really just I don't know, not smart enough, I guess. You know how when you're trying to pick up something heavy when you're shifting. And you kind of try to shift a fridge and you realize you just can't even move it. That's kind of what happens when I encounter kind of, complicated mathematics. So it's my brain just sort of says, that's you can't even begin to start to work on this. Which is kind of frustrating. I mean, I do use some statistics in my work and some discrete maths, and but yeah.
And so when you went to, went overseas,
Yeah.
you're still writing?
No, no,
Right.
no.
What, and was that, and was it easy to stop?
Yeah, I mean, my before that, the work was like, I couldn't even call it work. Like, I didn't kind of have a discipline, and I never finished anything. Well, I finished a couple of stories, but I don't think, I didn't kind of like rewrite them, or anything. So that, I mean, it wasn't kind of just serious writing at all. Yeah, it was only kind of when I came back to New Zealand and, started writing properly.
So how does a writer fit, you know, that thing we were talking about, you know, that life that there used to be, and is not anymore? How do you find time for writing? How do you, keep yourself fed?
Right.
How do you, what does that look like?
I mean, well, I have a job. I work here at the university in the biology department, and so, yeah, I don't rely on writing for, to keep myself fed at all,
Oh,
and I would be
thank
very
goodness.
foolish if I did. And so my routine, I wake up really early in the morning, and so I try to write for a bit then. And in the weekends, I kind of try to go. I do most of my good writing actually tends to come when I'm out walking. I just go for really long walks and think about, what I'm. And eventually, I sort of see it as kind of like a very disciplined version of daydreaming, in which I just let my mind wander, and it kind of the story does tend to just come to me most of the time. And, yeah,
And
it
then,
almost always works.
but then there's this really interesting thing I think with your work is that it's structured. It doesn't feel like I have read writing that's, you know, similarly imaginative and it just sort of goes more. But there does, what I find really great about your writing is that there's tension, there's surprises, there's, you know, how, so would a first draft, do you think about structure before you start writing, or do you write and then structure, or what does that look like?
I kind of, yeah, I do rewrite really, really extensively. Yeah, so I go through sort of three drafts of the last two books. So each have gone through three drafts, and each draft is basically a book. Like, it's, you write it out, and it's 100,000 words, and then then you kind of like figure out all of the problems, and then you rewrite it, and then and then you do that a third time, and so it's I mean, the kind of books that I chose to write were probably not books that I would recommend that first time. That was kind of a dumb thing for me to do. Books that have kind of multiple characters and over multiple timelines, it's just a really, really complex, and you end up throwing out huge amounts of work, like months and months of work. You kind of read it in the draft at the end and think, well, none of that was none of that worked, and it all has to go. So yeah.
And do you do anything visual to keep track of all that? Like I was, like, are you? I went into someone's office the other day, and they had, you know, like serial killers
String. Like the spider.
Do you have anything, or is it held in your mind? Like, no. Can you hold it?
I normally write. I would be cool if I did have a big whiteboard or something like that, but I don't have any room in my sort of work room. So no, I write like a really simple. I kind of write like a 3-part outline, and then I outline the chapters, and then I just kind of write them. Mm. When I'm writing action sequences, I quite often diagram them.
Cool.
And yeah, and if there's somewhere that is kind of geologically complicated, like the big compound in the second book, and the building and the tenement building in the first book, then I sort of diagram that so that I don't make dumb mistakes.
It occurs to me, I don't know if there's any way of answering this question, but it occurs to me that your books make me laugh, which I think is your, that's okay, isn't it?
Yeah, good.
I always get worried that laughing at the wrong things. I find them really funny, and it occurs to me that it must be hard to maintain that humour throughout multiple drafts, or is it not?
I don't know. What I've actually found is that the third draft, one of the revisions in the third draft, is usually when there's a phase where I go through and take out most of the jokes, and it makes the books funnier. And I don't really understand. I mean, it just sort of creates, it means there's a rhythm and a tension, and you're not sort of going for gags in every single paragraph.
It was really interesting. We've just been re-watching Strip Search, which is this thing that it was like a competition for comic writers. Penny Arcade were giving away a job at Penny Arcade. And it was really interesting talking about humour, talking about that rhythm, seeing it visually, you know what I mean? Like how he was like, oh, there's 3 pages in a gag, and here's a 3-panel gag, and here's a... And I think it is really... It really helped me thinking about writing humour and you know, like text for some reason. Did you set out to... Like, was that... Were you thinking, oh God, this is such a dumb question, but you're a funny person generally, and I guess...
Not personally, though.
Really. I find you incredible. Okay, but do you, like, was humour something you were thinking, yeah, I want it to be funny?
I think so, yeah. I mean, one of the writers that I really liked, and still do, was Evelyn Waugh, who, I think is incredibly funny. And I'm just trying to think. A lot of my favourite writers are those kind of, sort of mid-20th century, Kingsley Amis. I've actually only read one of his books. I've only read Lucky Jim, but I really like it.
And even Martin Amis can be funny sometimes. Yeah. Well,
I just don't really like him. I think I had a really bad start. People tell me that London Fields and Times Arrow are really good and Money, but I started out with The Information, which is just one of the most pretentious, tedious books I've ever read, and I think it really kind of ruined,
Times Arrow is pretty amazing, but I do wonder if it's amazing because it's got that one trick, what I mean? And like there's just this unfolding of, oh my God, this means this can't happen, and I remember the most amazing thing was thinking that he couldn't commit suicide. And I really like, he's got a book that has babies in the title. I quite liked that. But I've been so sporadic in picking him up that I've never read him with any intent. Humour is, I mean, I don't know, like I just think it shows great smarts and great craft. And I really, really love it. Some of the humour in your books is, I mean, like, I don't know, you may not consider... Some of it is what I'd call satire.
Yeah.
Where you take a realistic thing and make it bigger or, you know, and that kind of thing. And I think I was talking a little bit about that idea that there seems to be this... I've heard a few people talk about how satire's got to work up. You know, you can't make fun of something below you and stuff like that. I'm just wondering, do you think... How do you think satire operates in your work, but also, like, maybe in New Zealand as a whole? Yeah. You know, I was just thinking, there's some great cartoonists in New Zealand, But we're, yeah, and I guess you've got a little bit in the spin-off. I was just thinking about the wonderful piece that you did for the mural election.
Oh, right. Yeah,
like the one that was in the old age home, which is just fucking hilarious. Oh, but also seems to do something very powerful politically.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like there's the line where, I think, I'll probably get it wrong, but there's a great bit where you just say, she's a dreadful person. You know, like, I was just like, yes, you know, like, and I'm just wondering, that kind of non-fiction writing that you do, do you think that satire has a place in politics, or do you not see that as satirical, or
what? I don't know. Yeah, I do. I mean, some of the I really want to do that, more of that kind of writing, actually, because I also wrote this piece about John Key. And so yeah, I really liked doing that, and I kind of like to do that kind of writing a lot more. I don't know. Is it satire? I don't even know what kind of writing. I don't even know what kind of category it is. So the thing about kind of punching down and punching up, I don't know. I really used to believe that, and I kind of quite often sort of quoted that rule about people like Mike Hosking and Paul Henry when they said something that kind of I was really offended by, and I kind of am sort of I'm sort of resiling from this idea. Like, I still find those guys offensive a lot of the time, but I'm just resiling from this sort of idea that seems to be really prevalent in the culture, in which you've kind of got all these intellectuals and academics sort of running around enforcing these rules that they've made up about what people are and aren't allowed to say, and who, you know, what jokes everybody's allowed to tell. And I kind of, you know, I sort of, like, there's a line between, yeah, people do say things that are offensive and outrageous, and people should be free to be offended or outrageous. But yeah, the idea that there are these sort of quite, complex intellectual rules that just everybody else is supposed to, they're not written down everywhere. People kind of feel that they're, sort of, there seems to be this kind of, I don't know, cultural kind of almost priestly caste that have sort of, appointed themselves to manufacture and run around enforcing these rules. And I just think it's not a very, well, if nothing else, it seems like a very ineffective form of activism. It just basically makes people seem to, you know, be upset by it and feel that they're being oppressed. And that's kind of like quite a rambling answer to your question, which probably didn't have anything to do with
it. No, it did, because I think it's that interesting idea of an a priori rule. Like, I mean, because the thing is that until I see it, I can't tell how I feel about it. And I think that with me, often there's this thing where I don't want to have that danger of offence. Whereas more and more, I'm just wondering if maybe to say things right, a few people need to say them wrong, and we can get angry and decide that that's wrong. You know, like, and part of that action is really fun, but the closing down of it before it starts. And I totally get that there are some things that just don't need. Like, I mean, there's some things that don't need to be done. But I do find it quite interesting, especially around humour. You know, like, I just, I just think that that is one place. I'm just always interested in the power of it. You know what I mean? Like, the power of it just seems so huge. And especially in those two things that you wrote, you know, like, I was, you know, anger doesn't seem very productive. But sometimes there's nothing funnier than someone who's angry. You know what I mean? Like, you know, and I just think, especially the John Key, you know, like, I just think, I hope you do write more of that, because I find it really, really exciting. So we talked a little bit about maybe, I don't know, at the moment you're quite busy with a lot of things. What you're always busy with a lot of things, so you probably have to get up before you go to bed to do your writing.
Not really. I do. I do wake up really, really early, like at about 4:30 in the morning, which means that I do. Like, I mean, it does mean I go to sleep at about 8 o'clock at night. Kind of like, can just, my wife has never kind of like made peace with that. She's always outraged every night. Where are you going? What are you doing?
Cool. Sneaking away to bed. Yeah. I'm just going to bed so I can write in the morning. But is this a hard part? You know, you talked about the rewriting. Is this, I presume you're starting something new. Is that the toughest part? Like, I mean, the starting something new?
Everything. No, the starting something new is really, really fun. The toughest parts, I find, so, because I am working on something new, and it is really, really fun. But I know now from experience that after a while of kind of filling blank pages, I'll be really, really over it. and I'll want to be in the edit stage, because that is where you tend to make huge progress on the book. The stuff that you're filling the blank pages with is usually quite awful. And so, yeah, the book gets good in the edit. But I also know that after a while of the edit stage, I'll just be really, really sick of that stage of it as well. Yeah. So, yeah, it's kind of like a sawtooth pattern in which I'm really happy and then
unhappy. Yeah. And all of these things you have learned through practice. It's not like you went to a course and learned these things. And
Emily Perkins tells me I'm writing without a license.
I love it. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, what does it take? Like, we were talking a little bit about, like, for years I wrote with no publication, couldn't get into any courses, took on. Then I did the MA and all of a sudden there was this, I suddenly felt like there was some credence to my writing I'm just thinking about that time and I remember how hard it was, just rejection letter after rejection letter and sort of reading journals and thinking, it's all a closed club everybody, they seem to only like this. And I remember when I was writing poetry for the first time, realizing that all my poems were landscape and everyone else's were portrait. And I was just like, and then, so how does one maintain chutzpah? Like, can you talk a little bit about that? Like, I mean, was there a time where you were writing thinking, I don't know, what, can you talk about the time before publication? Although you may have been getting things published all the time.
No. I mean, well, in a way it was, because I was writing stuff on my blog.
That's right, yeah.
And I was writing lots of satire, which I don't really, actual kind of satire, like The Onion or whatever, and I don't really write that stuff. And so I didn't even know that any of the literary journals existed, and I still don't read any of them. And so, I mean, I was getting really, getting great feedback and, that was kind of how I sort of got my name out there, because I was writing that stuff. So, I don't know if that's a way other people should do it. I don't even know if that's...
And when you're writing the novel, that's... Yeah. I always find a novel really scary. Yeah. Like, when it's a short piece, the time commitment is low. But, I mean, there's always that terror, like... With the last thing I wrote, I think I wrote it four times.
Right.
Yeah. Like, it's virtually four books. Yeah. And it's not like you're redrafting. It was kind of like four totally different things. Okay. And it's kind of that terror. Do you feel... But I guess if you've got the plan, then you must have some idea, a better idea, maybe. Like, do you ever feel... Do you ever get... With that, as part of that sawtooth process, suddenly thinking, this was a bad idea.
Yeah. I mean, I get... I definitely go through periods of depression with each book, but also periods of elation when I finish it. And quite often those are very closely linked, like when I finish a draft, and now I sort of know better, but I still kind of feel when I get to the end, that is a stone cold fucking masterpiece. I don't even not have to change a single word. That can get, just go off to the publisher and it's going to change my life. And then I know, you know, from experience, that I just need to leave it for a month or so and then go back to it. And then I get very depressed because I think, Jesus, this is just a train wreck. It's gonna, I've got years and years and years to go on this before I can do anything with it. So,
I recognize that tremendously. I just, that idea, the thing that I really, that someone said to me, which I really like, is that when I read back over the draft, because I do it daily, like I'm on fire. And then the next day I'm like, this is really bad. But what I really like is that I can't tell the difference between the days where I was elated and the days where you read through it and you're like, I think that I didn't like this, but it's okay. It's as bad as the stuff that I wrote when I thought it was great. It's just a wild trip, eh?
It is.
I love it. Yeah. So that means that you must have a cutoff point at the other end when you write during the day, eh? Like if you start at 4:30, you must have to finish.
Yeah, I normally just sort of, I don't have a word kind of count or anything like that. I just sort of write. And then sometimes if I'm sort of excited by it, I'll kind of write at my desk at lunchtime or when I get home, although I generally don't have time.
It sounds like such, it just seems to, I mean, I guess it's hard and it takes commitment, but it's kind of like through the through the hardness and the commitment, it's sort of, and it's been so good. It's so wild. We've gone miles from Gleek, haven't we?
Yeah, we have.
Did you like the way I did that? That was not very good. I'm very bad. What else should we talk about?
I don't know. Do we have any other questions?
I think I've used all my questions.
Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah. No, there is a question. Okay. But I think you answered it. I'm interested in why Ara Valley? Like, why not Brooklyn?
Well, because I was living in Ara Valley. And so, and it seemed very, it seemed like really, really good material.
Mm.
Like, I think I was kind of, at one point, I was actually kind of nervous because I thought, this is such a great setting. I have to get this finished because someone else is going to reuse this and I will seem like I've just imitated them, but no one else has done anything with it.
No.
But I also found, because I've started work on a couple of different books after the last one because I want to do something different from Ara Valley. And the one that was really kicked off is one that is set in Plimpton, where I grew up. So maybe I'm just a writer that needs to write about places where that I kind of have a strong connection to.
And how do, I mean, it seemed to me when the first book came out, there was a lot of excitement in Ara Valley.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think, and people really did seem to like to laugh at themselves,
have a bit of a snigger and kind of go,
oh, yeah, remember that? And, you know, and especially with the tie in with the video story and the personality.
Campbell, yeah, yeah.
yeah. Has anyone come back to you and said,
a couple of people have. Well, the funniest encounter was after the first book came out and someone came up to me and sort of said, something, I can't remember the exact words, excuse me, Mr. So-called Ara Valley novelist, but I read your book, and I went and looked for that temple at the top of Apuni Street, and it's not there, and I got chased by someone's dog, so you have to fix that in the next edition or whatever, and so...
Oh my god, yeah. I so love that. Yeah,
but I mean, a couple of people have kind of said, oh, I tried to like it, but you know, you just get this, you know, you're just not like describing the sort of the topography of the valley accurately or something. They can't get past the fact that, you know, like that, like, the, you know, in the book, there's sort of an old road that, you know, is abandoned, and that road doesn't exist. And I kind of say in the introduction at the beginning that I've change the landscape, but some people just really can't get past that—the fact that it's not a totally accurate description of.
I just have this weird thing where I have this weird thing where sometimes when I was reading it and stuff, where I'd be walking through and it was like that imaginary landscape laid over the top, which I really loved, and that's what I thought was so cool about the bunker was, you know, the bunker is such a huge part. You know, I mean. We sell the Christmas trees out of there, it's a terrifyingly not very safe place. Yeah. At the moment, there is a lot of people sleeping there. You know, there's a lot of dogs and people sleeping there rough. Yeah. And, you know, the kids used to go up the top of it to smoke, you know, and to transform that into the archive in my head. Like, I just instantly was like, oh, yeah, the bunker could be an archive. Yeah. And all of a sudden, when I walk past it, it's kind of like this different place. And the house... that he goes into, and it's just it's incredible. Cool. I just love it. Oh, it's just so good. So definitely the time travel book I can highly recommend.
Yeah.
I really want to read the information book, and I understand that Gleek, is it true that he's working on a book about Isaac Newton at the moment?
He's actually written a biography of Newton, but I haven't read it. So yeah, he wrote his first book, Chaos, was about chaos theory, and it kind of popularized. I haven't read that either, to be honest. Even though he's one of my favorite writers, just because I'm such an undisciplined reader. It popularized the idea of the butterfly effect. That was kind of, you know, and so he's written a very good biography of Feynman, the quantum physicist. Yeah, called Genius. That's an amazing book. The information is very good. I'm probably forgetting a couple, but...
Because I mean, that was something wonderful that I found in the book, was that I was, like, I think I said to you, like, I have so much trouble with relativity. Like, I think I understand what they're saying, but it seems, this is going to sound so lame, it seems that my understanding of it is so simple that it can't be right.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I think I understand what they're saying is that... you know, you experience time differently in different places, you know, and that doesn't seem smart enough, you know, but it was really great reading the book because all these people, like Feynman, that I've sort of read a little bit about would come through.
Yeah, yeah.
And then because it was sort of in this idea where we're just thinking about our concept of time, it was quite incredible.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was amazing.
Yeah, I thought, yeah, I kind of thought that he didn't spend long enough on special relativity.
Yeah.
And yeah, he didn't quite explain that. Yeah.
I think I would have been staffed.
Yeah.
If he'd done that. But there was that incredible, that's, what I really liked was this, like this push and pull of culture and science, which
yeah.
I think is really, I don't know, like, do you find that, I mean, it's a silly thing to say because it just seems like it's imbued everywhere, but with, I'm sure I read an interview where you were talking about the mathematics that you're dealing with
oh,
in
yeah.
your job and how that plays into your writing. Does it? Does
oh yeah,
it?
That was something that I talked about. It was actually in another piece I did for the spin-off about the sort
yeah.
of five things I was thinking about for the book. And yeah, it was actually when I was studying computer science and you're dealing with kind of data structures, which sounds like it's going to be quite a boring thing. And these are ways to organize information. And like, when something goes wrong on your computer, it'll say something like B-tree error or something like that. And that's the data structure that all the information on your computer is arranged in. And something that you kind of start to wonder about when you're actually programming and dealing with these things directly is, are they real?
Mm.
Because they're not like instantiated in space-time. You can't touch a B-tree or a hash map or whatever. But they kind of seem real in the sense that they behave like real objects. They can do some things but not others. Everyone, they're not cultural. Everyone from any kind of different cultural, background will kind of encounter the same kind of structure. It's not like it's an alphabet or a language or anything like that. And so, yeah, that does key into a very old debate in mathematics and philosophy about, whether mathematical objects are real. Are they invented? Are they cultural or are they sort of some sort of like weird, basically mystical kind of platonic thing that exists outside of space-time but which we can apprehend somehow. Yeah, so that was... that's a big part of the second book.
Yeah, because that's one of the questions, like when the scholar...
Yeah,
seems to be the dark side, which is so... I don't know, like, which is so great.
Yeah.
That was one of the things I really liked in the Gleek book was... the chapter that sort of, I think this is how I read it, that posits the idea that the book is a time travel machine.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I just thought was just, and especially the book that he talked about, which whose name has just gone from me now, but
yeah.
Brent's reading it at the moment, and very weird coincidence happened where I read about that book, told Brent about it, and then it arrived from his brother in New York as a present. But like, this idea of, the book as the ability to change, and I guess that's what I'm talking about with the Ara Valley, it can actually reshape the Ara Valley, it can re-time the Ara Valley, it can have this multiple world effect.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that I was thinking about when I was writing that second book was that, so Einstein had this kind of conception of the universe as four-dimensional block time, and it's very deterministic, so the future already exists, it's just, there is no real change, we just experience the illusion of change. So our futures exist in the same way that like Greenland exists. We just, we've never been to Greenland. It's still real. Our future, we've never been to the future, but it's still real and we're kind of traveling through time at the rate of 1 second per second towards it. And so it did kind of strike me that, well, that's sort of how a book works.
Mm.
The characters kind of like feel that they have free will, but they're really locked in. The future is already there and already written. And I kind of thought that, wow, I'm such a genius. That's such an amazing thing for me to think. And then I read the Gleek book and like heaps of people have had the exact same idea and put it in their work. So that was kind of, bummer. But
because that's, that kind of blew my mind. Strangely, that blew my mind more than the idea of forking paths.
Yeah.
I was suddenly thinking, some of the science fiction time travel stuff that I've watched, and it's that thing that can't change.
Yeah,
I watched Arrival the other week, and it's that kind of thing like it can't change because that's how it is.
Yeah.
No matter like that idea of going back and trying to kill Hitler, but you can't kill him because he was there, and we're living in a post-Hitler kind of. And I just found that so incredible, and it made me think about how that trick that we play often in novels and contemporary literature, which is that idea of telling the present time through past tense.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like there's more books being written in present tense now, but this idea that you get the sense that anything could happen, yet it's being told in past tense, which I find really, I've always found, because somehow it feels more intimate and it's more immediate than present tense for some reason. Yeah. I don't know,
I know. Elizabeth Knox once explained that to me, which is that the past tense, because I don't really understand any of that sort of dimension of writing, I just kind of, but yeah, Elizabeth sort of explained that just how much kind of more versatile and much more elegant, especially if you're writing kind of complicated action sequences, the past tense is, much more powerful. But I have to admit, sort of forgotten what she said, and I just use the past tense because that's...
This is the thing that I find really interesting, like, there seems to be this move towards the present tense, and I do wonder, you know, what that's about, and it's that odd thing how first person often feels less intimate than third person, that weird, I don't know, like, first person should be the, you know, I should feel like I'm in your mind, but I can't be in your mind, so something strange happens. It's really strange.
Yeah. I guess you sort of have more, if it's first person, I guess you feel like they might be unreliable, whereas if third person, you kind of feel like the author is likely to be more honest with you about what the character is thinking. Maybe
completely.
That's
completely. Yeah. I think you're right. Like, I mean, it's like I always think about Scanner Darkly by because I always expected that to be a first person book, but it's not.
No.
And I think that just shows how fucking amazing Philip K. Dick is.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think I don't know. Like, and there was even that great little footnote about Douglas Adams. That was another person that I had forgotten about until I read this book.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think someone who we sort of just what we do with him.
Yeah.
You know, like, he's in a place where I think the world's big, it's really big, dolphins were doing experiments on us. But when I start to think about it, so many of my ideas were formed by some of his books, and you know, like, I just think there was that great footnote where he was talking, there's another footnote it was referring to, which I think might be in Restaurant at the End of the Galaxy. It's in one of those.
Yeah.
And it was talking about all these tenses that you can use.
Oh, that's
like,
right.
When you're
the
in
simple, perfect, past and present, future, to describe things that might happen but that you don't happen because you didn't want them to happen.
It was just so great. It was so wonderful. Yes, I highly recommend this book. Yeah. Is there anything else you want
to
say?
I guess the other thing that occurred to me just as I was coming in here is that it was, because I'm a writer, it was really interesting to read a book of literary criticism.
Mm.
But that there are so few of them that are sort of written for kind of non people that don't have kind of, you know, like, postdoctoral backgrounds in literature, you know.
Yeah.
When I try to read the kind of, I don't know, the academic stuff, it's really, really opaque. Like, I literally can't understand a single sentence of Lacan or Kristeva or Derrida or Judith Butler or whoever. It's completely inaccessible. And the justification for that is always, well, we're dealing with complicated ideas, but the stuff that Glick is talking about is really complex stuff. It's quantum theory and many worlds and special relativity, but he does manage to make it comprehensible. And so, it's just kind of a shame that, that in general the whole field is so completely inaccessible to anyone except a very, very, very tiny number of kind of academic specialists.
Because that's what I thought was incredible about the book, was the fact that I was learning about science and literature at the same time.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, the literary criticism sort of bent of it made it very useful for me to think about my own writing.
Yep,
like, I was sort of thinking, oh, that's how you do that. And then this wonderful sort of, what would you call it, bibliography that it gives you know, because I immediately went off and read a couple of the things that he talks about. And I was just thinking, it's like this course, you know, like, I'm really interested in, you know, writing something with non-linear time. And, you know, like, I just think it was just like this crash course in. And like you say, I wasn't kept out of the science, but in the same way, I wasn't kept out of the literary criticism either. It seems, I'm always in awe of that, because I think that when I do my own critical writing, there's a tendency to hide behind opaqueness,
right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I have one idea about this book, and I'm going to make it sound as complicated as fucking possible.
Yeah.
Whereas I think someone who can write clearly, concisely, and invite people in, I think that's a huge thing.
Yeah.
It's incredible. We should read it. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Bob.
And have a good day.
You too.